Okay, so it's not my most recent work, actually, but it's an update of a story that started back in 2001. And I guess this paper has most of the details, but some of the input to this story, both the calculations of radiative corrections and more significantly the data, have been moving around. And usually what happens when I, in the last few years when I give this talk in the spring, when I stand up to give it, either just before or just after the talk, an experimenter gets up and announces some big change in the data. So, like at
That's
this...
not going to happen here.
Well, I was wondering if maybe... I figured that here you guys would announce that you discovered that the universe has a granularity of 10 to the minus 18 centimeters or something. But barring that, at this workshop, which was in Berlin, I got an email just before I left for the airport from Martin Grunwald, who's the head of the Electroweak Working Group, telling me that the W mass had just moved down one sigma, which kind of undermines the case that I'm going to be telling you about a little bit. And then last year, I spoke here on this very day, April Fool's Day, at the end of a radiative corrections workshop. And on that very day, they announced that the top quark mass had gone up, which also undercuts a little bit what I have to say. So the problems that I'm talking about are not as serious as they were when I wrote this paper, but I think the issue still exists at some level, and you could judge for yourself how significant you think they are or are not. So, okay, that worked. So this is for any executives who need to rush off right away. You can leave after this slide. I'm just going to give you the punch. Well, I'm not giving you the details. It's like an experimental talk where you have to wait till the end to get the numbers. So this is kind of like that. But at least I'm going to tell you where I'm going. And there is one thing that happened this year in the story, which is that finally LEP has declared their analysis in the heavy flavor sector to be final. They did that in February. And so at the end of the day, this puzzle that I've been thinking about, that we have this one 3.2 sigma discrepancy between the two most precise asymmetry measurements, which are the two most important measurements to go into the determination of the Higgs mass, that there's this, it's now frozen at 3.2 sigma. It's been moving around between 2.5 and 3.5 sigma during the last 15 years, and now this is what they're going to say it is. And of course, it could generically be new physics, it could be a statistical fluctuation, and it could be a systematic error. And the main point of the talk is that if it's a systematic error, which I think a lot of people walking around in the halls, they dismiss it that way, and it may be true that it is, because it's a difficult measurement for a lot of reasons, both theoretical and experimental, then the most likely culprits are going to be the heavy flavor quark asymmetries. And in particular, the B quark is the most important of those by far. There is also the charm quark asymmetry and the so-called jet charge asymmetry, which is some sort of average of all of the quark charges. And these three measurements are all made at LEP. They are the most likely culprits if the problem is systematic error. And of course, everybody remembers or may remember the RB anomaly, where we were all chasing our tails 5 or 6 years ago because there was a 3 sigma discrepancy in this quantity called R sub B, which is just the ratio of B quark decays to all hadronic decays. And that one went away and turned out to be a systematic error. The problem was distinguishing between charms and bottoms. And when they cleaned that up, I'll talk about that in more detail. RB went right on to the standard model prediction. So the point is that if you take the B quark measurement out, if you assume that it's a systematic, that these guys suffer from a systematic error, and you don't know what it is, then you just have to leave them out of the fit. So if you make the assumption that that's the explanation of what's going on, then it turns out that the prediction that the standard model makes for the Higgs mass is way too low. It was way too lower 2 years ago than it is today. So that's the thing which the data has been kind of taking the the ground out from under me to some extent, but it's still low, and there still is an issue. So the point is that to the extent that you believe the fit saying that the Higgs mass is too low, you then, in this scenario, also get a signal of new physics, because now you're in conflict with another measurement, which is the direct search for the Higgs at LEP 2. So then you're left with that this could be either itself could be a statistical fluctuation or new physics. Well, today it's sort of a 10% problem, so it could be a statistical fluctuation. When I started this story, it was like a 2.5% problem. But I think a 10% problem is also something one needs to think about, and at least one has to recognize that it admits another possible interpretation of the data than the one you usually hear if you go to a meeting and some guy gets up and says, you know, the precision data beautifully confirms the standard model, and the Higgs is light, and they make that statement and walk away. And there's clearly another way to read the data, which is, I think, at least as viable as that one. So, as I was saying, the conflict with the LEP2 limit is diminished by the top quark measurement, by the new high value of the top quark, and we'll see whether that holds up or not. Some people think D0 is being very aggressive in estimating what their errors are here. And we'll see. I mean, when the TEV2 data finally comes in, we'll see where the top quark lands. And depending on how these parameters evolve, top quark, W mass, and also what the value of alpha is, how alpha runs, what the value of alpha is at the pole, at the Z pole, the conflict could disappear, it could get worse. Wake up. Okay, so the fits that I'm going to be describing, I ended up doing exactly like the Electroweak Working Group does them, because I didn't want to be open to the criticism that I wasn't, you know, doing the whole thing the way they do it. So at the end of the day, I'm using ZFitter supplemented by two loop calculations of the W mass, and also most recently of the effective weak interaction mixing angle. So the way these fits work is that you input values of the Z mass, the top quark mass, the running of alpha, the strong coupling constant, and the Higgs mass, and you scan over those. Or actually, I don't scan over the Z mass because it's known much more accurately than the others. So you don't learn anything by scanning over it. But I scan over the other four parameters, and then for each value, you calculate the various Z-pole observables. There are something like 13 of those, I think. Then you calculate the W mass. You can calculate the version of the mixing angle that's measured in neutrino scattering. And I use the same experimentally dominated value of alpha that the Electroweak Working Group uses, which is taken from the BES data, the analysis done by Burkhardt and Pietrzyk. I include the biggest experimental correlations taken from the Electroweak Working Group. The one thing I do that's different from them is that they recently added the W width to the collection of measurements that they're fitting, and I did not follow them in adding it, because it's not a precision observable in the sense of all the others. And so it's just not probing the physics at the same level. The typical measurements, the Z-pole measurements, and W mass too for that matter, typically a few parts per mil is the precision. And this is more like a few percent. So, I get good agreement with the Electroweak Working Group. And when I calculate the observables, I'm usually either I'm dead on to 10 to the fifth, or in the worst case, I'm two parts in 10 to the fifth away, which is a tiny fraction of the experimental error, so it doesn't have any impact. My chi-squareds come in pretty close to theirs. My searching routine is this little homemade thing, which probably isn't as good as the package they use, but I end up within a few tenths of their result for the chi-squared, and if I do this standard model fit with their parameters, I get their answers. And I've also done, I'll show you results from chi-squared fits, but I've also done maximum likelihood fits that give the same kind of answers. So the global fits then, the fit that I call all has the 13 Z-pole observables, then the W mass, top quark mass, the coupling constants, strong and electromagnetic, and then the Higgs mass. And the strong coupling constant and the Higgs mass are not constrained in those fits, because this is where you, well, obviously we don't know what the Higgs mass is, and this is the place where you can best determine the strong coupling constant. So you get it out from these fits. So if we fit everything, including NUTEV, then you get a chi-squared of 27 for 13 degrees of freedom, and you have a 1% confidence level for that fit. If you take out NUTEV, that's the fit I'm going to be calling the all fit from here on in, then you get 18 for 12 degrees of freedom, and so the confidence level for the standard model is 12%. So it's a 10%-ish thing, and in that fit, my fit, the Higgs mass is now up to 130. It used to be down at 114, but the top quark mass is responsible for raising it. And the upper limit I get is 260 at 95%. I don't know. That's very close to the electroweak working group numbers. So NUTEV is interesting. A lot of people suspect that there's systematic error in structure functions, and I don't know. Time will tell. It's not a very precise. It's not as precise as some of these other measurements, so it doesn't have much weight on the determination of the Higgs mass. The central value for NUTEV wants a Higgs mass of 3 TeV or something. It's way up there in dynamical symmetry breaking land, but the error is so big that it doesn't have a lot of weight in the fit. So it's a side issue. It's a separate issue, but it doesn't affect what I'm going to be talking about. So I'm going to set it aside. Where do I go? So then the main point I want to make here is that this 12% confidence level is a fair estimation of the likelihood of this fit, and it roughly reflects the probability for outliers relative to the sample size, and it's dominated by this problem of the front back B quark asymmetry versus the left right asymmetry. Basically, you've got 2 3-sigma problems here, and then here you've got 1 3-sigma problem. And you can sort of, you can see that by asking the following question. In the standard, in this fit, the pull of the front back B quark asymmetry is 2.8 sigma, and the left right asymmetry has a pull of something like 1.6 or 1.7 sigma. And so if you ask, what's the probability that you would have at least one such outlier among 12 independent measurements, the answer is 7%. So it's sort of in the ballpark of this 12%. So what I want to say is that the global confidence levels are fairly valued, and that you shouldn't think of this as the discovery of the latest glue ball. You know, the way you find a glue ball is you make a mass histogram with 1,000 bins, and then you find a 3 or 4 sigma bump, and you say that's the glue ball. And you know, obviously, that's not a fairly valued. You can't assess the likelihood that that you found something by just asking for the probability that something happened in that bin. You have to ask what's the probability something could have happened in any of the bins. So that's like asking this question, and so the relevant statistical ensemble is to replay this whole program from 1990 to now at these laboratories. You know, replay it 1,000 times and see what you get. That's what this number is. So there's this quote from that I think is from T.D. Lee, that in high energy physics, the probability that a 5 sigma effect is valid is something like 50-50. You know, and we all have that feeling about statistics in high energy physics. But what I want to argue is that these numbers here are really fairly valued, and they should be taken seriously. Statistically, they're fairly valued. Of course, one reason we have this feeling, TD's feeling about that, is first of all, sometimes the statistics isn't properly framed, and secondly, there are often systematic errors. So I'm going to address the issue of systematic error separately, and I want to say that statistically, this is something that we should take seriously. So the most important observable for determining the Higgs mass is the most important Z-pole observable, for sure. The top quark mass and alpha, as I already mentioned, are also important. Is this effective weak interaction mixing angle, And it's measured in five measurements at LEP and one measurement at SLAC. The one at SLAC is the one up at the top there, the left-right polarization asymmetry. It's a very clean measurement, and it's the most precise. And then there are two other measurements done at LEP, which are done in the purely leptonic sector, the front-back lepton asymmetry, and a measurement where you look at the angular distribution and polarization of taus, which gives you separate measurements of the ZEE vertex and the Z tau vertex. And those three measurements combine to this value 23113 with an error of 21 and a reasonable chi squared 1.6 for 2 degrees of freedom, 44% confidence level. Then you have the three hadronic asymmetry measurements from LEP, which are dominated strongly by the B-quark measurement. And they're all clustered very tightly around the B-quark measurement. So in the final, the combination is not so different from just the value of the B-quark by itself. The chi-squared is surprisingly small. The confidence level is very high. And then when you combine them, this is the value that gets quoted. You end up with this number in the middle, 23153. And you have a 3.2 sigma discrepancy between the leptonic and hadronic sector measurements, which is driven by this discrepancy that I already told you about of the two most precise ones. That's my suspicion. That's one suspicion, and that's my, that's one. That's what I suspect. But that, but there's an even worse story than this that I'll show you in a minute. I mean, there's. I think there's something going on here that they don't understand. There may well be, but they certainly worked hard at it too. So, anyway, if you combine all six measurements without grouping them in this way, then you get something like 12 for 5 degrees of freedom. So, 43.5%. Confidence level, which is still not brilliant. Okay, so let me explain a little bit about how you get, how you extract the weak interaction mixing angle from these measurements. So, for example, the front-back asymmetry of the B quark is the product of a factor that comes from the electron vertex and a factor that comes from the ZBB bar vertex. And those are just these combinations of the left and right-handed couplings of the fermion to the Z. And then in the standard model, the left and right-handed couplings are determined by the effective mixing angle for the fermion, the charge Q sub F, and then the weak isospin of the left-handed one. So the hadronic vertex for the B quark is this number 0.935. In the standard model, it's 0.935. And it doesn't care much about anything. You can move the Higgs mass from 10 GeV to a TeV and move the top quark several sigma, and it hardly varies. So it's really a prediction of the standard model that that vertex is 0.935. And where the sensitivity to the Higgs mass comes from is the leptonic vertex. And of course, that's because the leptonic asymmetry is proportional to a quarter minus XW, and X is very close to a quarter, so that's where you have all your sensitivity to X. So the way you get the mixing angle out of the front-back B-quark asymmetry is you assume in the standard model fit, and if you don't have a model, you can't extract it from this asymmetry. But if you commit to the standard model, then you calculate the leptonic vertex, and then you get another, so basically you're using it to get another window into the leptonic vertex. So A sub B, this vertex is also measured directly at SLAC. And when I started this story, this was also low by 2.5 or 3 sigma. It was quite consistent with, well, I haven't told you this is low yet, but I'm going to tell you down here that it's low. But now, and actually for the last 3 or 4 years, and this is now final, I believe. I don't think SLAC has quite blessed this number, but it hasn't moved for a few years, so it's probably going to end up here. Now it's right on the standard model, half a sigma. So it sort of takes the ground under a little bit the idea that this might be new physics. If this had ended up low then we would be much more strongly looking at taking this seriously, I think. On the other hand, it's sort of equivocal. You can combine the indirect measurement with this direct one, and you get something that's almost 3 sigma low, just because this measurement has a lot of weight. So the evidence for new physics is, at best, I would say, equivocal. So this discrepancy then between the measurements in the leptonic and hadronic sectors is significant because, first of all, it's a failed test for the standard model. The hadronic vertices don't seem to have the values that they have. I should have said that the way you play the game over here is you take, the way I determined AB over here was that I assumed that A sub L was correctly measured by the leptonic measurements. So that's what gives that low number. So it's a failed test for the standard model. It raises concern about how reliable the fit is of the Higgs mass, because you're taking these two measurements that are way off at other opposite ends, and you're kind of letting them have the value in the middle with a small error, and then you're just going ahead and calculating the Higgs mass, which made me nervous and why I got interested in this question. And then it contributes to the diminished quality of the global fit. It's responsible, basically, this problem's responsible for that 12% confidence level. So the problem could generically be statistical fluctuation, new physics, or underestimated systematic error. So a few words about each possibility. So I've already talked about a little bit about statistical fluctuation. What I want to say here is that the significance of the anomaly, the statistical significance, depends on exactly how you frame the question, as is always the case in when you try to analyze probability and statistics. And that the global confidence levels fairly reflect the likelihood that any of these measurements might have fluctuated to create this problem, and then you get these 10%-ish kinds of numbers to characterize the problem. Or if you ask a different question, you might be more concerned. Suppose you asked yourself, as I did, how consistent are the two highest precision measurements that are determining the Higgs mass? Then you're driven more towards worrying about the problem at a deeper level, at a more serious level. But in the most conservative assessment, we can say that there's an order 10% problem. What about new physics? That's a possibility, but there's an interesting constraint that comes from this quantity R sub B. At the end of the 90s, there was this 3 sigma R sub B anomaly, which was eventually understood as experimental error. That I guess charm quarks and bottom quarks were not being correctly separated, and eventually the experimenters figured out how to do that. And now the experimental value agrees within 1 sigma with the standard model prediction. And that puts a constraint on the sum of the squares of the left and right-handed couplings. Any new physics contribution to the sum of the squares is bounded to be, when you work it out, that 3 parts per mil up there translates to something like half a mil at the 1 sigma level. Now, the Funtbach B-quark asymmetry is measuring the difference of those couplings squared divided by the sum. And that is a much less precise measurement than R sub B. See, the error is something like 6 times bigger. And then you find this 3 sigma discrepancy, which translates into this value for the difference of the squares. So at this level, I'm just to crudely show you what's going on, let's suppose that this number is 0. It's a number much smaller than this one. So I'm going to end up with these numbers are going to end up being off by 30% or 40%, but you can see qualitatively what's going on. If you say that the sum of the squares has to vanish, then this is equal to minus that one, and then you can work out from here how big the shifts have to be. And the other important thing you have to know is that the left-handed coupling in the standard model is 5 times bigger than the right-handed one. So that ends up meaning that you need a huge shift in the right-handed coupling. I think when you do it right, this number might be more like 0.02 than 0.03. But anyway, you need a huge shift of order 25-30%. And in the left-handed coupling, you have a sort of 1%-ish size shift. So this means that it's very hard if it is new physics, I call it later the WBSM, which means way beyond the standard model. The literature was flooded with papers explaining R sub B. For one thing, supersymmetry could explain it, so of course there were going to be lots of papers explaining it. There have been very few papers trying to explain this anomaly, because it's very hard to make up a story to go with it. It looks like it would have to be tree-level physics, and you could do it. There was a paper by Tate, Wagner, and somebody else, I forget the third author, where they talked about mixing with fermions, mixing the bottom quark with some other fermion. You could play that kind of game. You could also mix the Z, custom design a Z prime to fit the data, but it doesn't have any legs. It doesn't have any physics motivation, which... It's the shift in the... There's a parenthesis here. Yeah, sorry. Yeah. No, you're not asleep. I didn't mean. You're not dreaming, Rich. Yeah. Yeah, the shift in the squares can be... Okay. Are you saying in the measurement or in the predicted value? You mean the predicted value? It's small. I mean, I don't think there's any. And yeah, I think that's probably under control. Well, you know, but R sub B is the ratio of the Z to BB bar divided by Z to all hadrons. So a lot of things cancel in the ratio. So to summarize, if there could be new physics, that if this discrepancy could represent new physics, maybe not. The measurement is challenging, as I'll discuss in a moment. The slack measurement, the slack direct measurement of A sub B pulls the rug out a little bit from under the hypothesis that this might represent new physics. And it's hard to explain that right-handed coupling. On the other hand, you know, hard, maybe we're not thinking in the right direction, and maybe it'll turn out to be true and tell us and point us in another direction. Could be true. One thing is, it's certainly, you know, it hasn't gone away. It's been there for the whole 15 years at something like this level. And I would say the experimenters have been, you know, suspicious of it and have worked very hard to try to make it go away, I would say. Maybe that's not a fair statement, but let's say they've worked very hard to make sure to understand the measurement as best they could. And at the end of the day, they finally said, well, you know, this is it. We're going to stick with this. It seems to me that if it is a systematic problem, though, it may not be their problem. It could be a theory problem. I mean, I think there are theoretical systematics which people think are under control, but I don't do this kind of physics, so I'm not exactly sure, but it's difficult. I mean, it's a much more sensitive measurement than R sub B, because you have to know which one was the B, which one was the B bar, and where it went. And if you're near the edge of the two hemispheres and you radiate off a gluon, that's obviously a correction that you have to know how to do. And then in addition, while I'm getting ahead of myself, I think this is on the next couple of slides, we measure hadrons, not quarks, and so that creates another issue. So it may be a difficult measurement for theoretical reasons. So The third possibility is that it's a result of systematic error, which is definitely above my pay grade, but I will dare to say a few things. The first is that the measurements of the leptonic in the leptonic sector seem to be very clean. There are no strong correlations there. Some of them happen thousands of miles apart, and the techniques are very different. The left-right polarization asymmetry, front-back lepton asymmetry, and then this tau polarization measurement, they're all very different measurements. And they have they're consistent at a reasonable level. So it seems very unlikely that there's common systematic error afflicting those three measurements. The opposite is certainly true of the hadronic measurements. As we already said, the chi-squared is suspiciously small. We know from the old R-sub-B story that there's this danger of confusing the B's and the C bars, and that happens to be consistent with the signs of the shifts in both the B and C measurement. And there's a 1 in 4 chance that could have happened, that's the pattern. But that is the pattern. And in fact, if you make a very small error, a very small, you only have to miss a few C bars and think they were B's or vice versa, and that gets amplified tremendously in the asymmetry because of the signs of the two asymmetries. It turns out that the effect gets amplified quite a lot. So it's more dangerous here than it was in R sub B. Of course, the experimenters are aware of that. I have asked them one question, which they didn't give me the answer that I would have liked to have heard. I have asked them if they could use the same data sample with the same separation of B's and C's that they use for the R sub B measurement to then make the front-back B quark asymmetry measurement, and the answer is no, they do not use the same data sample because the events are selected with different criteria for the front-back measurement. And then I've asked them, could you please tell me what value of R sub B you get from the sample that you use to measure the front-back asymmetry? And they've never told me that number either, although they must know that one, but I've not seen that. So those are things I would like to know to assure myself that this issue was under control, but it's surely one that they've worried about here. Then the other thing which is suspicious, speaking of low chi-squareds, is that if you look at the 14-parameter heavy flavor fit, which includes a whole bunch of other heavy flavor measurements, semi-leptonic branching ratio, da-da-da-da-da, a whole bunch of things that go into calculating these asymmetries, the chi-squared, and that includes measurements from slack and lep, the chi-squared from that is really small, 53 for 91 degrees of freedom. So you've got 3 9s and a 5. And the first time I noticed this, there were 4 9s and a 5, but now they've gotten it down to 3 9s and a 5. The electroweak working group says, I mean, one possibility, one reaction to this could be that the systematic errors are too conservative. So it's reasonable then, and they point out that if you set the systematic errors to zero, assume that they've way overestimated them and just go with the statistical errors, then you get a reasonable chi-squared. But then I redid the fits with that hypothesis, and not surprisingly, the problems that I was talking about get worse. So for example, the discrepancy between these two measurements drops by a factor of 2. The consistency of all 6 asymmetries drops by a factor of 2. And this standard model all fit, the one without NUTEV, drops by a factor of 3. So there's no free lunch for the standard model if you make that assumption. And as I was already starting to say, one of the problems here is that there's QCD-ish stuff, some involving gluons and quarks and some involving hadronization that goes into these measurements. Extraction of the quark, what we're doing is quoting quark asymmetries, but of course they measure hadrons. So there are models of hadronization, charge flow, they have to get the gluon radiation right, and so on. So there could be unique correlated QCD systematics for all three of these measurements, which might be difficult to quantify. you know, how do you put an error on this? Well, if you're lucky enough to have two theorists do the calculation, you see how close they were, and then you say that's the error. Well, of course, that's not the error. That's maybe a lower limit on the error, but it's certainly not a. But you know, there's probably no way to do better. So it could be that the systematic errors are actually much larger than the estimates, and these would be correlated systematic errors. So at the end of the day, what I want to say about systematics is that if there are underestimated systematic errors somewhere, then the leptonic effective mixing angle is most reliably extracted from the three leptonic measurements. So the rest of the talk is mostly focusing on this hypothesis of underestimated systematic error. And I want to focus on that not because I know that it's a more likely explanation than statistical fluctuation or new physics, but just to see what the consequences are, to see if it can improve the standard model fit. Because the man in the street, a lot of the men in the street say, okay, I know this is a dirty measurement, you know, to heck with it, and everything's fine. But now this other problem comes up and bites you, although it's not biting as hard as it did a few years ago. So we assume that they have, that those three measurements have underestimated systematic errors. We remove them from the fit. Then the confidence levels all get better. The consistency confidence levels all get better. So the all fit goes up to 70%. If I just look at the Higgs sensitive observables, and I guess I didn't show you that fit yet. I think I'm going to do it in a minute. But if you restrict yourself to the Z-pole observables that are sensitive to the Higgs mass, then you get a 4% confidence level, which is a way of saying that the problem is clustered in that sector. That goes up to 50%. And then if you just look at the most sensitive, the two most sensitive remaining measurements, which are the W mass and the left-right asymmetry, I'll show you in a minute that that has a very small confidence level if you include the B-quark measurement. But if you take it out, then you get something like 80%. So, but now the problem that emerges is that the Higgs mass is starting to be too low. And the problem is still here, although not as severe as it was. Now, just a side remark on what is the meaning of the limit from LEP2 on the Higgs mass. LEP2 tells us that the Higgs is heavier than 114 JeV at 95%. And so, some, you know, you might think that means that there's a 5% chance that it's less than 114. That's not what it means. What it, yeah, I'll say it, I'll explain in a minute. But what does it mean? This is what it means. It means that if the Higgs did weigh 114 JeV exactly, then there's a 5% chance that they might have missed it. But what's the probability that it's lighter than that? Well, it's some number much less than 5%. To calculate it, you'd have to make some kind of a estimate, some kind of prior. You'd have to estimate what you thought the probability distribution was for the Higgs mass, and then you could convolute that with the limit at each different energy. But the point is that, say, this limit comes from their running at their highest energy. But at their highest energy, they already exclude Higgs being 100 JeV, they exclude it at 99.99% or something, or 999. The exclusion gets very high the minute you back off from the highest value. So, you know, you could make some kind of model and convolute that with all these different limits at each energy. You'd end up with a number, but the number is going to be way, way less than 5%. You know, at 112. Maybe there's 1%, and at 108, it's, you know, a tenth of a percent. It goes down very rapidly. So you shouldn't think that there's all of 5% room below that value. Okay, so this is bad pedagogy. I guess I forgot. This slide maybe should have come sooner, but what I'm doing here is asking, what's the consistency of the complete set of measurements that are sensitive to the Higgs mass? So it turns out that that there are five Z-pole observables that are exceedingly insensitive to the Higgs mass. They hardly move as you change the Higgs mass by two or three orders of magnitude. And that's the hadronic cross-section, the R sub B, R sub C, and these factors A, B, and A, C. They don't go anywhere. And if you calculate the chi-squared of the remaining observables, then you get 15 for 7 degrees of freedom. So the problem is more severe in that sector. And then if you just take the three most important observables, then you get this 3% number. And I've shown you here that if you just take these three, you get a fit. The Higgs mass comes in at 139, and the upper limit's at 280. So you've captured most of the information in the fit from all of the observables with just these three guys. So again, the poor quality of these fits suggests, again, it could be statistic systematics or new physics specifically within the electroweak breaking sector. So the question is, how reliable is the prediction that we get? Now, it helps to look at the individual components of the fit to see where they want the Higgs to be. So the left-right polarization asymmetry today has a central value of something like 55 GeV and an upper limit at 165 and has a confidence level of 14% for the Higgs to be in the allowed region. And these numbers were all, 2%, 3%. The central value is at 20 or 30 GeV in the good old days. The B quark measurement wants a Higgs up near a TeV. And the 90%, the symmetric 90% confidence interval starts at 220, above the upper limit from the left-right polarization measurement. The reason that the B quark measurement is the one that has the biggest pull in the standard model fit is basically, you can see that in the next line over here. The point is that the W mass is an ally of the left-right of the leptonic measurements. Both the W mass and the leptonic measurements like a low Higgs, so they gang up on the hadronic asymmetry measurements, and that's why, at the end of the day, the left-right polarization has 1.7 or 1.8 sigma pull, but the front-back B quark measurement has the 2.8 sigma pull. It's because of the help of the W mass. And that also used to be more dramatic before the W mass moved down by one sigma. The higher W mass lowers the Higgs mass dramatically. And then if you look at the aggregates, the leptonic asymmetries, the hadronic asymmetries are virtually identical. They are identical to the B quark measurement. So the B quark measurement really dominates the other two. And then if you add the other two observables, Z pole observables, which are not asymmetry measurements, and lump them together with the W mass, then you get this very low central value and something like a 20% confidence level that the Higgs is heavy enough to be consistent with LEP 2. So the support for the Higgs to live above 114 comes primarily from the hadronic asymmetry measurements. And these are some pictures of the chi-squared distributions. This is the chi-squared distribution for the left-right polarization. This is the tau measurement, and this is the front-back leptonic asymmetry, and this is the combination of the three. And then the hadronic asymmetry measurements with the minimum here at 700 GeV, and you can see that the whole story is in the front back B quark measurement. And then these are the combined hadronic ones and leptonic ones, and these are this is the 5% lower limit, and here's the 5% upper limit. And then this is the W mass, and then this quantity R sub L, which is the ratio of, I think it's Z to leptons divided by Z to hadrons, I think. Not just the branching ratio, I think it's the ratio of leptons to hadrons, whatever, which kind of gently trends down like a light Higgs. And then there's this funny shape in the Z width, which has two minima. The electroweak working group always shows this one, but they're both there. And then finally, the numbers from the global fit. So if I take the fit of what I call the all fit without nu tev, then I have, I'm 132 is the central value, 55% confidence level to be in the allowed region. If I take out the hadronic asymmetry measurements, this goes up to 70%. Higgs mass goes to 70, down to 70 JeV. And now I have 14% confidence level for the Higgs to be in the allowed region. If I just look at the Higgs-sensitive observables, then again I take out the hadronic asymmetries and the central value goes down to 64 JeV and there's a 17% probability to be in the allowed region. And then if I just take the two most important measurements that are left over after I've removed the B-quark measurement, which is the left-right polarization and the W mass, then I have a 50 JeV Higgs and a 12% confidence interval to be in the allowed region. So if you think that's a problem, could at that, 14%, it could be a statistical fluctuation. And what's fluctuating? Well, the top quark mass. The top quark mass goes up another sigma, then I think this problem goes away. If it goes down a sigma, then then it comes back in spades. And the same thing, alpha can move around, W mass can move around. So statistical fluctuations in those observables can affect how bad this problem of consistency with the LEP2 data is. But if you take it seriously, or if it turns out at the end of the day that it is a problem, and you don't want to say it's a statistical fluctuation, then it's another sign of new physics. So there is, one can imagine new physics that would raise the prediction for the Higgs mass into the allowed region. And there are a couple of papers by people who took this, the problem I'm talking about, seriously. And they, so Guido and four other mafiosi got together and found a corner of the parameter space of the MSSM where you can take care of this. But they're very exposed. I think they have a very light slepton, which I think might be, maybe could be ruled out by TEV2. And then Okun et al. Find that there is room. We often hear that a fourth family is excluded, but I think that's based on oblique approximation. And they did a more complete calculation, and they find there is room for a fourth family, and then they can raise the Higgs mass. So that's another possibility for that kind of new physics. And generically, oblique corrections, which means basically new physics that contributes predominantly through the gauge boson vacuum polarization, vacuum polarizations, for example, parameterized by these parameters of Peskin and Takeuchi, can allow you to basically dial in any Higgs mass you want. It doesn't have any effect on the chi-squared. So, for example, but you can have any Higgs mass. So, for example, if I take that fit where I've removed nu tev and I've removed the hadronic asymmetries, and then I, to that data set, I allow the oblique parameters to vary, then the confidence level gets, modestly smaller, but all values of the Higgs mass are allowed. So here's a picture of that. You read the chi-squared to the left, and the S and T values are read to the right. So here's the standard model fit with the Higgs coming in, I think it was around 70 GeV. And here's what you get if you allow S and T to vary. So I allow them to vary freely. And then at the chi-squared minimum for each value of the Higgs mass, this shows you what the S is, and this shows you what the corresponding T is. And what you see here is that you need negative S, something like minus 0.2, in most of this region. This has been known for a long time for, you know, Technicolor type modelers. And it's not easy to get negative S. Positive phi is easy to get. That's just isospin breaking, like, you know, the top quark, B quark mass difference gives you a contribution to the Rolle parameter. T is like a new physics contribution to the Rolle parameter. So if you introduce anything that gives you some additional isospin breaking, you can get some positive T. Negative S is harder to come by, but we now have these multi-dimensional engineers who have a lot of flexibility, and they can, they have more knobs to turn. The people playing the five-dimensional games, the Higgsless five-dimensional games. And I don't know. At the end of the day, there are examples. There are examples of negative S around, and there's no no-go theorem, but it's not easy to find models that do that. So this is the ElectroWeek schematic diagram that sort of summarizes the global situation. So you start up at the top with 2 3-sigma anomalies in a confidence level of 1%, and now you can go in any one of 3 directions. If you say that either of those anomalies is real, then you have new physics. And until you know what it is, you can't say anything about the symmetry breaking sector. You can't use the precision data to tell you anything about the symmetry breaking sector, because you need a model to interpret it. Or you can say it's a statistical fluctuation, which you can always say, and then you're entitled to proceed with your standard model fit and get out the usual answer. Or you can say there's systematic error, and then everybody's favorite whipping boy is NUTEV. So first thing you do is you throw out NUTEV, and then you get this 12% confidence level for the remaining fit, 4% confidence level in the Higgs-sensitive sector, and you have this 1.5 parts per mil discrepancy among the leptonic and hadronic asymmetries, or the B quark measurement and the left-right measurement. And then again, you have all 3 choices: new physics, statistical fluctuation, and this is the road that the ElectroWeek working group takes. This is the road that the guy takes when he gets up at the meeting and tells you that the standard model works fine and the Higgs mass is 130 and this is the upper limit on it, taking this road. Or you can take this road and say that these problems, and to the extent that this number is low, these are due to systematic errors in the heavy flavor asymmetry measurements, and that then you're left with this problem, which again you can go off in either of these 2 directions on. So conclusion is that this problem of the discrepancy between these 2 precise measurements is not going to go away. It's now been cast in concrete. It's been preliminary for 15 years, but now they finally have said these are the final measurements. The left 2 limit on the Higgs mass makes the problem more persistent because there's a preference, at least for new physics, whether the B quark measurement has a systematic error problem or not. And the standard model and the usual statements about the Higgs mass require order 10% statistical fluctuations, which is certainly a possibility, but it's also a possibility that one of the order 90%, you know, that the order 90%-ish phase space is where the, you know, where nature is. And in that case, we either need new physics to understand the measurement of the B quark asymmetry, which requires this big shift in the right-handed B quark coupling, or if we say there's a systematic problem here, then we need new physics to raise the prediction for the Higgs mass, which seems like an easier road to go, but who knows. So the bottom line is that the precision data leaves plenty of room for surprises, and the good news is that the LHC is going to be able to look for the mechanism of symmetry breaking over the entire range of energies allowed by unitarity. So provided we get the luminosity that we're supposed to get out of the LHC and the detectors work the way they're supposed to, at the end of that program we should know what the mass scale is for symmetry breaking, even if it turns out to be surprising. What's he doing here? Are you a lattice person? What are you doing here?
Keep an eye on
us. Oh. No, I don't think so. You know, I don't think it would change this. I guess you'd have to look at the combination that has the Vav, and I don't think it would help at the end of the day. I mean, the bounds are slightly different in the two Higgs doublet model. The left two limit would move around. And in the MSSM, the bound is not exactly 114. There's some complicated parameter space. A lot of it exists pretty close to 114, but there are parts of it where the limit is lowered below 100. So they're probably, you'd have to, I guess that's probably where you have the most wiggle room. You have to make up the model of how your Higgs decays, what the decays look like in this two doublet model, and then you would probably find a different output from the left two search.
Okay, I'll thank you much again.